Well, I'm delighted to be here. This is my first visit to Perimeter, but I hope not my last. I thought that the thing you'd be most interested in hearing about is the current status of Lambda CDM. The basic story is that on large scales, it's a fantastic success. On small scales, there are what I'm calling challenges, but my bottom line is going to be that none of them look as serious as some people claim they are, and it looks to me like Lambda CDM is probably going to be okay. But it's not clear, and work remains to be done. So that's going to be the latter part of the talk. In a little bit more detail, I'm going to do a quick historical introduction to Lambda CDM, just in case there's anybody here who doesn't know what it's all about. And it is the modern standard theory of cosmology. And then I'll talk about some of the big successes on big scales, galaxy correlations, the power spectrum, cosmic microwave background, satellite galaxy abundance, and downsizing. And then I'll talk about these various issues on small scales. In particular, the thing that has been called for years the angular momentum catastrophe, which looks like it's not a problem at all. And the issue in the centers of galaxies, whether there's a dark matter cusp where the dark matter has a roughly 1 over r density behavior, where r is the radius, and that's connected with something that's known as the too big to fail problem. And then I'll summarize the evidence that's emerging for cold dark matter substructure in dark matter halos being real substructure in galaxies. There's real evidence for this. And the evidence is gravitational lensing flux anomalies and gaps in cold stellar streams. So that's, I think, very strong evidence that the substructure that cold dark matter predicts is really there. So a brief history of dark matter. Fritz Wicki in 1933, and then in a really good article published in English in 1937, showed that the large relative velocities of the galaxies in the Coma cluster indicate that the Coma cluster has a very high mass-to-light ratio. In other words, that there's a tremendous amount of unseen matter in the Coma cluster. He called it Dunkel Materie, which in the article was published in 33, it was in German, which is just dark matter. So it gave the subject its name. It's in some ways an unfortunate name because dark to most people means black, absorbing light. And the idea here is dark in the sense of not luminous. Dark matter, as far as we can tell, is completely transparent. It doesn't shine though. Then in the 70s, Vera Rubin and Mort Roberts, using optical and radio astronomy, showed that the velocity of stars and gas going around spiral galaxies doesn't fall off with distance the way the velocities of the planets in the solar system fall off as 1 over the square root of the radius from the sun. And that means that unlike the solar system, where practically all the mass is in the center, the mass has to increase linearly with distance from the center, because v squared is Newton's constant times the mass enclosed out to a radius r over r. And if v is constant, that means mass has to increase linearly with radius, which means that the density has to fall off roughly as r to the minus 2, so that r squared dr over r squared integrates to r, and you get a constant velocity. So that's the implication of these flat rotation curves. So that meant that most of the mass that holds galaxies and any other bound structure, clusters of galaxies together, must continue out to very large scales, but with falling density. And the evidence was controversial. There were all kinds of different pieces of evidence. There were several hundred papers by 1979, about half of which were actually wrong. And Faber and Gallagher in 1979 published a very influential review article in Annual Reviews of Astronomy and Astrophysics that reviewed all of the literature, threw out the roughly half papers that were wrong, and the remaining papers were basically incontrovertible, and that article, I think, is what really turned the tide and convinced most astronomers that dark matter is real. There was a brief period when the standard view was that the dark matter is a light neutrino. In Moscow, some experimental physicists thought that they'd measured the mass of the electron neutrino to be about 30 electron volts. And Jacob Zeldovich and his group jumped on that and said, ah, it's neutrinos that are the dark matter. And Dick Bond and I coined the term hot dark matter for that, as compared with warm and cold dark matter for things that were moving more slowly in the early universe. The neutrinos would be moving relativistically. It was a short period because by 1984, a fairly convincing article had shot down the hot dark matter theory. Because in a hot dark matter theory, galaxies don't form first. First, you have to make cluster size objects because the galaxies, the fluctuations in the scale of galaxies are washed out by the rapid motion of the dark matter. And George Blumenthal and I worked out the cold dark matter theory, and together with Sandy Faber and Martin Rees, we wrote an influential article that presented cold dark matter and compared it with the first redshift survey of galaxies, the first redshift survey at the Center for Astrophysics at Harvard, which was the first chance we had to really begin to understand large-scale structure. And our conclusion was that the theory seemed to work. That paper predicted a certain level of the fluctuations of the cosmic background radiation, and the Cosmic Background Explorer satellite discovered fluctuations of exactly that magnitude in 1992. And I showed with my then graduate student, John Holtzman, that there were only two possible variants of cold dark matter that fit the data even before the COBE data became available. And those were lambda CDM, so cold dark matter with a cosmological constant, with omega cosmological constant of 0.7 and cold dark matter of omega 0.3, or total matter, and that's of course basically the currently favored theory. And the other possibility was a mixture of cold and hot dark matter. And when the COBE results became available, those were exactly the same two theories that they favored. By 1998, the discovery using type 1a supernovae by two different teams of the accelerated expansion of the universe told us that it's lambda CDM that's the right theory. And then there was a bunch of other data that became available roughly in that period of 97, 98. For example, the distance to the globular clusters with the oldest stars in the Milky Way had been underestimated. And the Hipparchus satellite, for the first time, gave us distances to 100,000 stars and allowed a recalibration of the distance scale. And that showed that the oldest stars in the Milky Way were not, as had been thought, 16 billion years old, but were actually about 12 to 13 billion years old. And the lambda CDM picture gives an age of the universe of about 14 billion years, so everything looked okay. Whereas up until 97, 98, cosmology was just full of conundrums, like stars older than the universe. So most people didn't take cosmology seriously. And so I think of 1998, 15 years ago, as being when cosmology became a serious science. Of course, some of us had been taking it seriously before that. So lambda CDM is accepted as the standard cosmological model. WMAP, the NASA's Wilkinson Microvanisztatri Probe satellite, the European Space Agency's Planck satellite, and many studies of large-scale structure, LSS, confirm lambda CDM predictions. And we're very ripe for discovery of the dark matter particles. We have no idea yet what they are. There's very interesting hints, which I wasn't planning to talk about today, but you can ask me. So the modern theory of galaxy formation, I think, really starts with this paper. This was Simon White's thesis paper with Martin Rees. Both of them were much younger back then. So the key ideas are that every galaxy forms as a concentrated luminous core embedded in an extensive dark halo. to propose a specific model in which omega is 0.2, so that's the total mass of matter. As I said, we now think it's about 0.3. The dark matter makes up 80% of the total mass, and half the residual gas has been converted to luminous galaxies by the present time. The only part of this that isn't right is that the fraction of the gas that's been converted to luminous galaxies is much less than that. In the most successful cases of converting baryons to stars in galaxies, you get about 20% conversion. That's the case of the Milky Way. Most galaxies are much less efficient at converting gas to stars. But the basic picture was essentially right. There was, however, one crucial thing that was missing, and that was, what's the spectrum of the matter, the dark matter halos that within which galaxies form? And that's where cold dark matter came in. So the basic idea of structure formation is what's known in the trade as gravitational collapse. Astronomers say that one region of the universe with more matter is richer. So we talk about rich clusters of galaxies and poor clusters. So the coma cluster is a rich cluster. Our nearest cluster, the Virgo cluster, is considered to be a poor cluster. It doesn't have very many galaxies. Gravity magnifies differences. So any region that has more than average amount of matter is going to grow a little bit more slowly than average. A region that has less than an average amount is going to grow in size a little bit more rapidly, and so its density is going to decrease faster. And although the universe expands almost perfectly uniformly, with only very small, a few tens of parts per million differences from place to place in the early universe, there's a lot of time, and so those differences get expanded. This is actually one of the very first published simulations of a collapsing bunch of matter particles. This was done by Jim Peebles in 1970. So these, what's the idea is that there's some external lower density out here, but by Birkhoff's theorem, the generalization of Newton's theorem, anything that's spherically symmetric that's outside this radius won't have any effect on it if this is a spherically symmetric distribution inside. So we can ignore the outside. So the idea is that there was a uniform density. It expanded. At this point, it's at maximum expansion, so everything is basically stopped moving. And then the particles fall together, but they don't all fall to the center because they're interacting with each other gravitationally. And this is the most concentrated that they get. And then they expand out, and they're flying around all the time. But if you take a snapshot at any time after this, it's going to keep looking basically like this. And this had already been predicted, actually, by Donald Lindenbell in 1967 from statistical mechanics arguments. Lindenbell called this phenomenon violent relaxation. He tells me that, of course, this is a British tongue-in-cheek sort of humor. It's violent because it happens on the first fall. It's relaxation because this is essentially a relaxed system. It doesn't much change. And there's a very simple argument you can make using the virial theorem that tells you that the typical radius after this process of virialization, of relaxation, is about half the maximum radius, just from conservation of energy. And so the idea is that you start with a uniform density, and then after it's virialized, the sort of average density, its sort of uniform density in the center, a roughly 1 over r squared density across much of the volume, and then falls off on the outside. And as I said, a 1 over r squared density distribution gives you a flat rotation curve. So this was a simple explanation of how matter that just interacts gravitationally can naturally give this flat rotation curve phenomenon that was observed in galaxies. There's a nice paper by Frank Hsu that explained the Lindenbell paper. So many people in the old days thought that the early universe was going to be extremely complicated. James Misner had this thing called the Mixmaster universe. Jerry Oestreicher invented theories with more and more violent explosions, baryonic explosions, to try to move matter around. Zeldovich had a very different idea. He was one of the people who provided the idea that the fluctuation spectrum is such that as the universe expands and it encompasses larger and larger volumes and larger amounts of matter, the fluctuation amplitude, delta rho over rho, will be invariant as you consider larger and larger regions. So that's called the flat spectrum or the Zeldovich spectrum of fluctuations. Actually, it was originally proposed by Peebles and Yu and by Edward Harrison, and it was named as usual after the last person who discovered it. Zeldovich wrote the shortest and most obscure paper on the subject. But anyway, it is essentially the right idea, and it was later on shown that it's a natural prediction of inflation, something very like the Zeldovich spectrum. In any case, the first idea was that the stuff that the universe is made of is ordinary matter, baryons. And it was shown by Zeldovich and many other people that if that's the case, the fluctuation amplitude in the cosmic background radiation has to be at least a part in 10 to the 4. And by 1980, it was known that the fluctuation amplitude is less than that. The Russians had measured that, and several people in the West had measured that. In other words, they'd found that delta T over T is less than 10 to the minus 4. And so that's what required that within this framework, something else has to be the main form of mass in the universe. And as I mentioned, Zeldovich jumped on the idea of hot dark matter, light neutrinos, because of this erroneous experiment in Moscow, among other things. George Blumenthal, who's now the chancellor at UC Santa Cruz, and he was my investment partner, and his office was just a couple of doors down the hall from mine. Physics and astronomy have always been mixed together at Santa Cruz, fortunately. So George and I started working things out, and our first guess was what's now called warm dark matter. And then with Sandy Faber and Martin Rees, we developed the cold dark matter theory. And we always describe cold dark matter as particles that move sluggishly in the early universe, which of course is a call out to our mascot at the University of California, Santa Cruz, the banana slug. Anyway, so Heinz Pagels and I published a paper in PhysRev Letters, in which we proposed, we showed that in the then popular version of supersymmetry, the lightest particle, if R parity is conserved, is naturally the gravitino. And we showed that it would have a mass of around a kilovolt. In other words, many times the mass of a light neutrino. And that's warm dark matter. And then in this paper, we actually worked out what the consequences of that would be for structure formation. And we say that you'd form galaxies by gravitational instability, that's this phenomenon I described, while avoiding various difficulties associated with a neutrino-dominated universe, because the hot dark matter picture was already known to be in possible trouble. So we published this paper in Nature in 1982, and then there was this response. Peebles published this paper in APJ Letters, and since the paper was partly inspired by our paper, George Blumenthal was sent Peebles' paper to referee. We immediately saw that although the paper had a very nice idea, that instead of considering warm dark matter, he said, let's assume the mass is large enough that the motion of the particles, the random motions near the universe are practically negligible. So that's what we would now call cold dark matter. The paper actually has two mistakes. He left out the neutrinos, and he didn't even calculate the fluctuation spectrum correctly. We saw that, but we decided that the paper should be accepted because it had key ideas right, and then we set out to do it right. So there's a long series of papers that preceded our paper, the cold dark matter paper. Here's the cold dark matter paper, and this is the rogues gallery. So the dark matter on all scales may consist of axions, stable photinos. The axion had been put forward by Michael Dine and others. Photinos would have been the natural possibility in the more modern version of supersymmetry, which had become popular in 1983. Our other collisions particles whose velocity dispersion in the early universe is so small that fluctuations of galactic size or larger are not damped by this process where the particles just move aside, move around, as they're moving so fast. This hypothesis has considerable predictive power. The fluctuation spectrum is calculable, and it in turn governs the formation of galaxies and clusters. Good agreement with the data is obtained for a Zel'Dovich spectrum of primordial fluctuations. That's the scale invariant spectrum. So we concluded that the straightforward interpretation of the evidence favors omega of 0.2. Now we think 0.3 is about the right value. In the cold dark matter picture, that means as a fraction of critical density. The dark matter is about 0.2, now we think 0.3, but that you couldn't yet rule out a Einstein de Sitter case, omega matter equals 1. The model predicts roughly the observable mass range of galaxies. For the first time, we understood why galaxies have roughly the masses they do. I'll show you that in a few minutes. The dissipational nature of galaxy collapse, the observed Faber-Jackson and Tully-Fisher relations, these key scaling relations for elliptical and spiral galaxies, dissipationless galactic halos and clusters. It seems reasonably consistent with large-scale clustering, which had just become available with the Center for Astrophysics Survey, including superclusters and voids. It merits close scrutiny and testing, which it's received ever since. So in 83, George and I published this idea. So we just worked out what happens. This is the amplitude, the log of the amplitude, delta rho over rho, and this is the scale factor, 1 over 1 plus the redshift. So scale factor 0, I mean, log of scale factor equals 0, scale factor equals 1, is today. And in the Zel'Dovich spectrum, everything comes across the horizon at the same amplitude. So this is where they're coming inside the horizon, that dashed line. And what happens is that these 10 to the 6 and 10 to the 9 and 10 to the 12 solar mass fluctuations don't grow very much because they're trying to grow in a universe that's not dominated by matter but dominated by radiation. Radiation is the dominant things that are effectively massless, photons, neutrinos, even electrons in the early universe. And then the universe becomes matter dominated at something like 30,000 years after the Big Bang. And then all these grow at the same rate, basically linearly with the scale factor. So there's this piling up of the smaller scale fluctuations, and that leads to this characteristic shape of the cold dark matter spectrum. It's very different from white noise. It's not that you're throwing down stuff randomly. It's not random at all. So this is what happens when you start with the Zel'Dovich spectrum, uniform amplitude as you cross the horizon, and then you just put in this fact that there isn't much growth until matter becomes dominant. That's what gives you this characteristic shape. And that makes all kinds of predictions, including you can actually measure the fluctuation spectrum directly. And I'll show you the data is in extremely good agreement with it. There were many other discoveries about cold dark matter. And one that's going to play an important role later in this talk is that the dark matter has this characteristic behavior of roughly r to the minus 1 density distribution on small scales, switching over to r to the minus 3 on big scales, and you can parameterize that like this. So this is 1 over r, 1 over 1 plus r over r sub s quantity squared, where r sub s is this break radius where you switch over from r to the minus 1 to r to the minus 3. This is for a more massive halo, this is for a less massive halo, and the consequence is that the circular velocity, the square root of gm over r, has this kind of characteristic shape. It's not constant, but across, this is a log, across much of the range of the sort of central region of a dark matter halo, it's practically constant, but it falls off at large scales, and it grows at small scales. So that's how the velocity looks. So there were many predictions that we made regarding cold dark matter before the data came in. I already mentioned that we predicted correctly the amplitude of the fluctuations in the temperature of the cosmic background radiation. So this is from a paper in 2004. And what we showed was that if you look at the correlation function, essentially the excess probability of finding a galaxy at a certain distance from another galaxy. So the probability of finding, you're sitting on one galaxy, the probability of finding another similar galaxy at distance r is the little volume that you're looking in times the average density of galaxies per unit volume times 1 plus the correlation function. So when the correlation function equals 1, that's double the random probability of finding a galaxy. Okay, that's what correlation means. And what we showed was that on small, so it was already known from this survey in 1983 that the correlation function has almost a power law shape. But from the point of view of cold dark matter, what we showed was that this actually arises where you've got two galaxies in the same halo, that's this red part, out to about a megaparsec, and two galaxies in two separate halos beyond. And it's just a coincidence that you get roughly a power law. And to show that it's a coincidence, just consider what happens at higher redshift. As you go out in redshift, the halo becomes smaller and denser, and so you get a higher probability, a higher correlation function on small scales, and a shallower correlation function on large scales. Now, no data was available at redshift 1 or redshift 2 or 3 or 5 when we made this prediction. It was a real prediction. And then the data came in. So this is actually the nearby data, which was analyzed within a few months of our making this prediction by Edith Zahavi. And then at redshift 1, the data came in a year or two later. And the blue curve is our prediction. The red curve, the red dots are the data. And then the Subaru telescope and others measured out to redshifts 4 to 5, where you really see this single halo term, two galaxies in the same halo, much steeper. I was actually shocked that it worked so well. This is a current summary of the data on the shape of the power spectrum. Remember that characteristic shape of cold dark matter? You couldn't ask for better agreement than that. This is galaxy scales. This is Lyman alpha forest clouds, little clouds of hydrogen. This is clusters of galaxies and all the way out to the horizon. This is the data that was just released in March by the Planck satellite. This is the part that had been measured by balloon flights and earlier measurements by COBE. And this part, first seen in balloon flights, this first peak, and then measured very accurately by WMAP and confirmed by Planck. And then these smaller angular scales, higher angular numbers, every one of these points is essentially an independent observation. The green curve was, the basic shape was calculated decades ago from cold dark matter. And to fit, you just have a total of 6 key parameters that you can vary. And they were already largely determined. So this is a fantastic success. And the same theory, this is the temperature-temperature correlation. This is the temperature polarization and the polarization-polarization. So there are simply no discrepancies. This is the summary from Planck paper 16 on cosmology. So they considered many, many complicated models. None of these models are favored over the standard 6-parameter lambda CDM cosmology. The effective number of relativistic degrees of freedom is 3.3 plus or minus 0.3, so consistent with the standard 3 species of neutrinos. The poor fit to the spectrum at low multiples is not of decisive significance, but is an anomaly in an otherwise self-consistent analysis of the temperature data. So this is the anomaly. Do you see it? This is the biggest discrepancy. Let me help. There it is. Notice how all of those are a little bit below the prediction. So between angular number L, this is, you know, for YLM, so this is the L. Between 21 and 27, there seems to be, they all seem to be a little bit low. So, I mean, there are various other anomalies, quote unquote, that people have pointed out, but we're talking about, you know, sort of 2 sigma. This is the Planck value, taking into account much other data for the Hubble parameter, and it's a bit low, but it's very consistent with WMAP, and considering the uncertainties, it's pretty consistent with the earlier determinations. So I now want to show you some large-scale structure simulations and comparisons with observations. So the first great attempt to do large-scale structure simulation was called the Millennium Run. It was done by Volker Springel and collaborators and published in 2005. And it allowed for measuring the properties of halos, the evolution of the number density of halos, evolution of the distribution and clustering of halos, accretion history of halos, halo statistics, and then void statistics, the cosmic web, merger trees, so the whole history of how every halo formed. And it was definitely a computational tour de force. Another simulation by Springel was of dark matter halos the size of Milky Way, the halo that hosts a galaxy like the Milky Way. This is one of those simulations. And you'll notice all the substructure. We're going to come back to this. And this is the size of the visible galaxy, about 100,000 light years across, and that's the size of the halo. So the halo is more than 1,000 times the volume of the galaxy. How does this fit into the cosmic web? Like that. So this is the Bolshoi simulation. This is the successor to the Millennium simulation. It's done with a more modern set of cosmological parameters and with much higher resolution, reflecting the fact that we've got bigger, faster computers and better code. Let's zoom in on just 1,000th of the volume of this simulation to get a sense of what it looks like. So that's the dark matter halo of a big cluster. And you can see that these big halos form where filaments intersect. The dark matter that hosts galaxies and little groups of galaxies tends to concentrate along lines. And this, incidentally, is the reason that you have a roughly 1 over r squared correlation function. It's because the effective dimension is linear. So the universe is sort of fractal, roughly, over a certain range of sizes. So these high-resolution simulations allowed us to calculate very precisely the predicted correlation functions, and the agreement is really spectacular with observations. This is the entire merging history of that one central halo. So what we do is we keep track of every particle. Every particle, there's almost 10 billion particles, has its number. And we keep track of every particle in every halo. And we see how halos form and merge. So we stored 180 time steps for this simulation. And from time step to time step, we're finding every halo and then seeing how the halos merge to form the halos at later time steps. And this is the merger history of just one halo, that big halo at the center of the picture I showed you. And all of this data is publicly available, the entire halo catalog and the entire merging history. Now, one of the ways that one can compare observations with these simulations is to fill the halos with galaxies according to a prescription called halo abundance matching or subhalo abundance matching. My former student, Risa Wexler, likes that latter term. So the abbreviation is SHAM because it's a sham. It's not a real simulation. And the idea is that you rank order the halos by their maximum circular velocity. Remember, the velocity grows, has a maximum, and falls, and the maximum occurs fairly close into the center. And that's a better way of characterizing halos than their total mass, which is not well defined once a halo becomes a subhalo and starts getting stripped by tidal forces. So we rank the halos by their maximum circular velocity. We rank the galaxies by their stellar mass, effectively. And we assign galaxies of a given stellar mass or luminosity to halos such that the number densities are essentially right. So that's called subhalo abundance matching. And so this is what the halos look like, and this is what the galaxies look like, and the color codes the mass. And then we can compare statistically the real universe and the simulated universe. And an example of how we do that is For every halo, we know what its maximum circular velocity is, and we've put a certain amount of mass into that halo. And then we can see what the correlation is between the mass and the circular velocity. So the line is the prediction, and this is data, and it's different kinds of galaxies. Incidentally, there's the Milky Way, and there's the Andromeda galaxy. And this is from a paper we published in 2011 based on the Bolshoi simulation. And the agreement is pretty good. This is the abundance of dark matter halos, and we compare that with the abundance of galaxies. For halos above 400 kilometers a second, it's groups and clusters. The agreement is pretty good here, but at 80 kilometers a second, there's a discrepancy of a factor of 2, and at 50 kilometers a second, there's a discrepancy of a factor of 10, which could either be a big failure of the theory, over-predicting the number of galaxies, or just incompleteness in the observations. So there's been a much more complete, much more detailed survey of the nearby universe by Klipin, Karachensev, and Massanova. It hasn't yet been published, but my collaborator Klipin assures me that all of this data is solid and it will be submitted soon. And what you see is that there's no discrepancy at all at 60 kilometers a second. Remember before we claimed, we showed that there was a discrepancy of a factor of 2 at 80 and a discrepancy of a factor of 10 at 50. Well, at 60 there's no discrepancy, and at 40 there's a discrepancy of a mere factor of 2. So this is from a survey that has 813 galaxies within 10 megaparsecs in the northern hemisphere, 686 galaxies. And most of them are spirals and dwarf irregulars. And this suggests that maybe the theory is doing okay. On these smaller halo scales, it may very well be that these halos are either not producing any stars or not producing enough stars for these galaxies to be detectable. So this doesn't look like a very big discrepancy. Another test we did was, this is supposed to represent the Milky Way and the large and small Magellanic Cloud. So how often do you get two bright satellites like the large and small Magellanic Cloud? You can ask the Sloan Digital Sky Survey and you can ask the Bolshoi simulation. And the little red points with hardly any error bars are the Bolshoi simulation, because of course it's enormous. And this is what you get from Sloan. There's only about 3,000 Milky Way analogs in strip 82, which is what was the deep strip that was analyzed. But every point, no satellite, one satellite, two satellites like our galaxy, three satellites, agrees with an observational errors. Now, the Planck, yes? Pardon? Oh, we'll come back to the small satellites. That's, of course, one of the small scale issues. So this is the two key parameters for cosmological simulations. The fraction of critical density that's in matter, ordinary matter plus dark matter. Ordinary matter is about 4.5%. So the dark matter is about 26.5%. So these are the results from the 5-year, 7-year, and 9-year WMAP. In black and gray are the results from cluster observations, which are pretty consistent. This is from the Baryon Oscillation Spectral Survey BOSS. And this is the new Planck result. Now, it is rather different. But their errors are really small. And they argue that they've taken a lot of data into account. It's not just the cosmic microwave background data. And it's all really pretty consistent. So this is sufficiently different from the parameters we used in the Bolshoi simulation, that's this green dot, that we decided we'd better rerun the simulation. So we just finished rerunning it, using up almost all my computer time. So I've just put in a request for some more computer time. This is on NASA's biggest computer. So we've started to analyze the new Bolshoi-Planck simulation. Now, the Millennium simulation used the first year WMAP parameters, which are very different from our current parameters, even from the later WMAP parameters, and are now 8 sigma away in both of these two directions. This is the power spectrum amplitude. This is the cosmic dark matter fraction. So millennium is hopelessly out of date, besides which it isn't very high resolution compared to what we can do these days. So we've made all of our stuff publicly available, and we'll shortly make the new Planck run publicly available. We've also done much larger runs. So this is, in black, Bolshoi at redshift 5 and redshift 3. This is basically the number of halos versus their maximum circular velocity. And the red dash curves are a big simulation with 58 billion particles in a box that's 64 times bigger than Planck, than the Bolshoi. We, despite the fact that this doesn't look like it agrees so well, it's basically just because it's a bigger box, so you've got some big waves. So on the biggest scales, you expect this difference. So they're actually very consistent with each other. Just from Bolshoi, we measured the abundance at redshift 5 compared to our Bolshoi run. So this is the Bolshoi-Planck versus Bolshoi, just the ratio of the number of halos. And you see that there's more than 3 times as many halos at 400 kilometers a second internal velocity at redshift 5, and also more than twice as many halos at about 600 or 700 kilometers a second at redshift 3. So this is going to alleviate the concerns that large clusters are being found at high redshift. It's also going to make reionization of the universe much easier than we had thought. So one of the classic arguments against cold dark matter has to do with a phenomenon that the galaxy observers discovered years ago called downsizing by Len Cowie. So the idea is that in lambda CDM, small things form first. It's a hierarchical theory. Whereas galaxies have the property that the massive galaxies, the most massive elliptical galaxies, are old, and their star formation occurred in the early universe. And so large galaxies form first, and small galaxies form later. And isn't that inconsistent with this basic picture of hierarchical structure formation that cold dark matter gives us? And the answer is no, not necessarily. The mass assembly is described by the cold dark matter, but the star formation history could be rather different. So this is this old criticism. And the key to explaining this downsizing phenomenon is the realization that star formation is most efficient in dark matter halos with masses around 10 to the 12 solar masses. And this goes back at least as far as the original cold dark matter paper. So this is one of the figures in the cold dark matter paper. And these bands are the predicted fluctuation spectrum. 1 sigma would be just sort of the standard fluctuation spectrum. And these would be the rare high fluctuation peaks. And these are the cooling curves. If you're below these cooling curves, then gas can cool on a time scale short compared to the free fall time. So cooling of gas will not inhibit the formation of structure. Whereas if you're outside the cooling curves, then you can't cool. So this is where groups and clusters will form. Within the groups and clusters, the individual galaxies, which are smaller, would be down here and they could cool. So the band where you actually get efficient formation of galaxies is somewhere between 10 to the 10 and 10 to the 12 solar masses. And this is a very recent paper that I highly recommend. It's part of Peter Baruzzi's thesis work with Risa Wexler at Stanford. And the key point is that what they're showing here is the star formation rate over the mass accretion rate. And this yellow is very efficient star formation. And you see that except in the early universe, where you can get efficient star formation in small halos, for most of the history of the universe, this is early universe, this is today, you got star formation primarily in this band around 10 to the 12 solar masses, which is roughly the mass of the Milky Way halo. So the basic picture is, if you have a massive halo today, so like the halo of the Virgo cluster, its growth in mass occurred roughly like this. And so it crossed the efficient star-forming band many billion years ago, back at redshifts of 1 to 2. So that's when it would have formed most of its stars. Whereas if you're talking about a small halo, like a dwarf galaxy, then that galaxy is just crossing into the star-forming band in recent history. And so it's still forming stars vigorously, and it doesn't have very many old stars. So this naturally explains downsizing. Now, to be honest, we're still trying to figure out exactly why star formation is most efficient in here. Basically, we think that there's a lot of feedback from, for example, central black holes for these massive halos, and there's a lot of feedback that's very efficient at ejecting gas and preventing star formation just from supernovae and other stellar processes in these small halos. But that's still very much work in progress. Sir, yes?
What mass is growing by time?
What mass is, so the idea is, why does the curve look like this? Well, because remember I showed you how we keep track of the dark matter halos. And
this is merging.
Yeah, it's just merging and merging and merging. I mean, basically, my former student, Risa Wexler, showed back in 2002 that the mass accretion history of a halo can be represented as mass as a function of redshift is mass today times e to the minus some constant times redshift. So it's just logarithmic growth in redshift. And so that's what I plotted. That's the best one parameter fit. And that was based on simulations, but also on analytic techniques. So these are also from that same remarkable paper by Baruzzi et al. So this shows the efficiency of converting, this is the stellar mass to halo mass, and it shows you that the best you can do is about 0.03, about 3% of the mass of the halo as stars. And that occurs at around a little over 10 to the 12th solar masses. So there's roughly where the Milky Way is. And so the cosmic baryon fraction, about 14%. The Milky Way mass, so that's that 3% for objects like the Milky Way. About 20% of the baryons in a Milky Way mass galaxy are being converted into stars. This is just to give you the arithmetic so you see it all fits. And at both higher masses and lower masses, it's much less efficient. And this is the history of star formation in the universe. That's the star formation rate versus time since the Big Bang. And the red curve is their best fit. And that's very consistent with a lot of data. So this is large-scale structure. Now, let's move over to small-scale structure. And here we do simulations where we include the baryons. So that's called hydrodynamic galaxy formation. You have to cool the gas starts to form stars, the stars inject energy, which can then heat the gas and drive it out. And so we have to try to take all of these phenomena into account. The three main topics that people have raised concerns about are angular momentum, cusps, and satellites and subhalos. I mentioned the cusp issue, that the dark matter has this 1 over R density distribution on small scales, but many galaxies do not have that. And so is that an inconsistency? That's the cusp issue. Now, the angular momentum issue was that all the simulations up until quite recently did not produce realistic galaxies. They did not produce a galaxy that looked anything like the Milky Way, or for that matter, anything like elliptical galaxies. And the problem was that the baryons, the ordinary matter, was losing angular momentum. It was transferring its angular momentum to the dark matter in a way that's completely inconsistent with observations. And so a number of papers called this a catastrophe. So here's an example. This shows the angular momentum of the stars in one of these simulations. This is the z component of angular momentum, that's the angular momentum axis, z, divided by the circular angular momentum, in other words, the r times v, that's necessary to just support circular motion. And what you see is that there's just a tiny amount that would form a disk. Disks are supported by their angular momentum. And the vast majority of the stars are in a large region that's not supported by angular momentum. In other words, they're just whizzing around supported by random motion. And this doesn't look like any real galaxy. It certainly doesn't look like a spiral galaxy where, except for these few stars in the center, most of the stars are just going around and supported by their angular momentum. There was a big comparison of many of the simulation codes that was published last year. It was called the Aquila Galaxy Simulation Comparison. Cecilia Scannapieco was the first author. And this is all of these JZ over JC curves, and not one looks like a realistic galaxy. However, in 2011, the so-called Eris simulation was published. And Eris was done by Javier Agudas, a graduate student at Santa Cruz. Her thesis advisor was Pierre Almadao. And what they did was to take one of the best simulation codes available and run it with higher resolution than anyone had ever tried. This was the first time anybody had ever done this. And it took about a year to run. It took about 2 million CPU hours. And when it finished, they got a galaxy that looked just like the Milky Way. It had most of its stars in a rotationally supported disk. It had a thick disk. It had a few stars in a bulge, about the right properties to correspond to typical spiral galaxies like the Milky Way. Yes?
Where did all the go?
What happened was that, so the great thing about the simulations is you can take them apart and understand exactly what happened. So what happened was that a lot of the low angular momentum material fell to the center, but there were repeated episodes of ejection because a lot of stars would form and they would have supernovae and they would blast the material out of the center and much of it would be lost to the galaxy. Remember, only at most about 20% in a galaxy this size, about 20% of the gas is going to turn into stars. The vast majority has to be kept out of the central region where the galaxy forms. And so these feedback processes are what do that. And the earlier simulations hadn't included very much feedback, and they didn't have enough resolution to even address these questions. So this was the first high-resolution simulation. And I was, you know, every few months I would ask them how it's going, and they kept saying, you know, it's really looking good. It's amazing. It's really fun. And it wasn't that they adjusted anything. This was the first try. So this wasn't my work, but I was really impressed. Now, people had tried to suppress the cores, tried to suppress the cusps and turn them into cores, flat density distribution, by assuming that the dark matter maybe is warm dark matter, the kind of thing I was talking about earlier. And there's a lot of papers that explain why warm dark matter doesn't work. This is one of the best ones. They call it a catch-22 problem. Basically, what they show is that the kind of warm dark matter you need is not consistent with a lot of other things. And there are other papers that show that there's really no version of warm dark matter that could explain what we actually see. So warm dark matter is not the solution. I'll come back and show you another example of trying to use warm dark matter to solve a problem where it just doesn't work. So this is a paper that was just published last year. Fabio Governato, Adi Zolotov, and many of these people are either longtime collaborators of Governato, like James Wadsley from McMaster. I think he's from McMaster, right nearby. Or Christensen and Brooks are students. And the point here is that these are all galaxies that have cores. In other words, if you describe their central density as r to the alpha, alpha is between about 0 and minus 0.5. So 1 over square root of r to constant density. So the blue curves are measurements from a big survey called the Thing Survey. And in that same range of masses, of stellar masses, 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 10, what the simulation showed is a consistent behavior, very much like what they see. And on smaller scales, very low stellar masses, these little dwarfy galaxies, they predicted there'd be a cusp. And the one of these galaxies that is down in that range does look cusp-y, and there are several others that are known to be. So this was very reassuring, that if you just, this is a similar code with resolution not as good as Eris, but pretty good. And so it's looking like things are actually pretty consistent. The next thing I'm going to talk about is the too big to fail problem. And it's perhaps the most serious current challenge for Lambda CDM, and it may indicate a more complex theory of dark matter. But high resolution simulation substructure is consistent with flux anomalies and galaxy-galaxy lensing anomalies and indication of substructure by stellar streams. So that's the final stuff I'm going to talk about. I'm nearly finished. How am I doing on time? Okay, good. So remember, this is that Aquarius simulation, and it's got all this substructure. And this is the satellites of the Milky Way. There have been a few new ones discovered since this picture was made. Most recently, Segway 2, a tiny little galaxy with a stellar mass of about 700 times the mass of the Sun. Now, here's the problem. If you look at this simulation, and there's about 10 of these simulations, they all have the same property. There's a bunch of subhalos, typically about 10 of them, that have circular velocities, maximum circular velocities, in the range of 25 to 50 kilometers a second. But the satellite galaxies of the Milky Way only range up to about 20, with an error bar maybe expanding up to about 25 kilometers a second. There's one more, Sagittarius, which is currently in the process of being ripped apart by the Milky Way, that probably started out somewhere up here. But there should be 10, according to this. Where are they? If these guys were big enough to form stars, surely these guys would be too big to fail to form stars. So my former student, James Bullock, coined this term, too big to fail. Of course, that was originally applied to the banks. Is the Milky Way anomalous? No. Very similar story for Andromeda. Does the Milky Way have a low mass dark matter halo? Well, it's still very controversial. One of the most recent papers claims that the Milky Way's halo only has a mass of 0.8 times 10 to the 12 solar masses, which would slightly alleviate this problem. Instead of there being 10 of these objects, there might only be 6 of these objects, but still, that's 6 too many. Is there something weird about galaxy formation at low masses? Well, maybe, but you'd like to have a better understanding of what's going on here. There have been several papers that said maybe the dark matter isn't cold dark matter, maybe it's warm dark matter, or even self-interacting dark matter. And the key paper on that is by a former student of mine who did his senior thesis with me, and it became a first author APJ paper, Miguel Rocha, who's now finishing his PhD dissertation with James Bullock. And this is a tour de force, but it may not be necessary to have self-interacting or warm dark matter. So warm dark matter, there's this paper by Lovell et al. And so they just redid the same simulation, but with warm dark matter. See, no substructure, hardly any at all. No too big to fail problem. But keep in mind that no substructure, because I'm going to show you evidence that there's a great deal of substructure right inside the Milky Way. So that would completely rule this out. It doesn't have a too big to fail, but it doesn't have the substructure. We actually have evidence is there. So maybe the high-resolution cold dark matter-only simulations are being misinterpreted. De Baryon strongly modified the structure of subhalos. So remember the logic here. The logic is we do this simulation pretending that all of the omega matter is cold dark matter. Then we put in baryons and see if the baryons have enough energy, you know, stellar energy, to blast out baryons and thereby modify the dark matter. So that's the logic that Boylan, Colchin, Bullock, and Kaplan had used in their too big to fail papers. But the logic is wrong. Because that's not what really happens. What really happens is that there's a mixture of ordinary matter and dark matter. And the ordinary matter can start to form stars. And in fact, the ordinary matter, the key point is, ordinary matter can lose energy. It can radiate energy away. And the result is that it can form a very dense central concentration of gas and stars. And the stars can become supernovae and blast the gas away. And so what was gravitationally dominant in the center is now removed. It's like a sudden approximation. So the whole thing expands. And this can happen several times during the process of formation of the dark matter halo. And that's what a number of different people have looked at. Let me just quickly go over it. So this is a paper that compares a dark matter-only simulation with a simulation where you do dark matter and baryons. And the trouble with this simulation is that they had 174 parsec force softening. The scale that you're interested in is about half a parsec, half a kiloparsec to a kiloparsec. And you never trust anything at less than 2 to 3 times the force softening. Well, our force, you can't really trust this inside of about here. So it's barely adequate resolution. This is from the same work. This paper is now published. This is the dark matter halos, including the ones that would be too big to form, too big to fail. And the point is that when you include the effects of the baryons, they move down. So the red things are the things that would probably form satellites, but they're not inconsistent with the Milky Way. Here's a different paper, very high resolution simulation, but not terribly realistic. This is the pure dark matter case. This is what happens when you include the baryons. These points are the observed satellites of the Milky Way. Looks very consistent. This is a paper in progress. Actually, this part has already been submitted. It's on the archive. And then I'm going to show you one more curve, which is still in progress by this group. So this is Sijin Shen et al. The et al.s include Piero Madao. So this is this other group at Santa Cruz. And they have 7 dwarfs, which they've named after the Walt Disney, Snow White and the 7 Dwarfs. There they are. And these are field dwarfs. They're not near a big galaxy. And this is that curve I showed you before from the Beruzzi et al. Paper. And the point is that these are very consistent with it. There are 2 fairly bright ones, Doc and Bashful. They're named their rank order of mass, and then this is just their alphabetical order, in case you wonder how they sign these names. And this shows that the metallicity that's predicted from their high-resolution simulation is very consistent with observations. Now, this shows the density distribution at redshift 3, 2, 1, and 0. And the dashed curves are that 1 over R, NFW, Navarro-Frank-White. And what you see is that every one of these guys has formed a core. This is a much higher resolution simulation. So this is beginning to relieve this problem that the resolution wasn't good enough. So very quickly, let me just tell you about this evidence that there really is all this dark matter substructure. So these are typical examples of optical quads, that is quadruply lensed quasars. A very common situation is where you've got the lensing galaxy here, the Einstein ring goes around like that. You've got 2 images of the background quasar close together and 2 far apart. There's a theorem that if the mass is more or less uniformly distributed and you have a case where you've got these 2 close together, they have to be equally bright. There are 6 cases where we have radio quadruply lensed quasars. And in 5 of the 6 cases, these theorems are badly violated. There's one example. The only explanation is that there's substructure along the line of sight that's lensing one or the other of these objects, and it would do this kind of a thing. And so that means that we then know there has to be a huge amount of substructure, and the mass has to be 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 8 solar masses. 10 to the 6 could be globular clusters, but that's the high end of globular clusters, and there aren't nearly enough. So the evidence, as analyzed by different teams, is that this is implying about the amount of substructure that lambda CDM predicts. there's this remarkable paper that shows that with ALMA, it should be possible to get 50 to 100 examples that will very clearly separate, either confirm this or rule it out in the next year or so. And then with LSST and James Webb Space Telescope, you know, in a decade, it should be possible to get much more data like this. Then finally, there's this evidence of stellar streams. So the idea is that there are little baby galaxies or globular clusters that are being torn apart by the tidal field of the Milky Way or Andromeda, and they produce these streams of stars. Now imagine that there's these thousands of dark matter halos of 10 to the 6th to 10 to the 8th solar masses that are constantly going through these streams of stars. What are they going to do? They're going to pull some stars along, and they'll make these funny little comma-shaped gaps in the stellar streams. So people simulated that, and then they went and they looked to see if it's really true. And these two groups say, yeah, the presence and frequency of these inhomogeneities suggest the existence of a population of missing satellites, that is, these subhalos, in numbers predicted by standard lambda CDM. A statistical argument that the vast predicted population of subhalos is indeed present in the halos of galaxies like M31 in the Milky Way. The most recent paper by your colleague Ray Carlberg from CETA and Toronto. So these are these little gaps in the stellar stream. And in substantial agreement with lambda CDM prediction. Well, this is the region that's been searched so far using the Sloan survey for satellite galaxies. And that's how big it is compared to that picture I showed you repeatedly of the dark matter halo of a Milky Way galaxy. So in other words, we've hardly begun to look. In the next few years, we're going to be looking much deeper, more or less like this, with the dark energy survey in the southern hemisphere, and then even much deeper in the southern hemisphere with the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, LSST. So conclusions, I won't read them to you. Sorry for going over a few minutes. I'll be glad to take questions. Thank you. Yes?
Up to now, the idea is that dark matter dominates everything. Barriers don't matter.
Except in the centers of big galaxies like the Milky Way.
This is no longer true.
Pardon?
Now that you have a problem with substrate, you're changing your mind. Barriers do matter. How does the dark matter fluid know what to do? If you look across the data, it's amazing how the dark matter fluid traces barrier. How does it know how to do that?
Well, the basic picture of lambda CDM is that the only interaction between the baryons and the dark matter is just gravitational. That's all that's put into the simulations. And the simulations, as I've tried to show you, once we get high enough resolution, are actually reproducing very accurately what we actually see. So I'm not sure what you're referring to in clusters. There's a whole literature on the centers of clusters.
Well, you look across the data. It's a fact. Between the dark matter and the Newtonian mass and dynamical mass different factor 10. And you see how from the data how there are two fluids, dark matter fluid and baryonic. Dark matter fluid knows how to trace baryonic fluid very accurately.
Let me try to clarify, because you said at the beginning that we assume that the baryons are basically not very important and the dark matter is controlling. That was never true. No one ever thought that about the centers of galaxies, or for that matter, the centers of clusters. Within the 8 kiloparsecs that we are in the solar system from the center of the Milky Way, roughly half the interior mass is ordinary baryons, half is dark matter. If you look out, practically all the mass is dark matter. But if you look in, as you go closer to the center, the baryons become more and more important and the dark matter less and less important. In the central few kiloparsecs of the Milky Way, baryons are completely dominant gravitationally. So it shouldn't be surprising that in the dense sense, the basic idea is ordinary matter can radiate away its energy. And so it can fall in and become dense. The dark matter, as far as we can see, has no way to get rid of its energy. Once the dark matter halo forms, it's stuck, but it can respond to the action of the baryons. So for example, if the baryons become dominant, and then suddenly on a timescale short compared to the gravitational timescale, the free fall timescale, they can push out the baryons, which had been dominant, that will expand everything. And if this happens a few times, you can easily remove the cusp in the dark matter. That's what these simulations have repeatedly shown. And then there's a nice analytic treatment that shows that, yeah, not surprising, that can happen.
Well, just one more point. There's an alternative to the dark matter in the modified gravity, the dark gravity is not correct. And in that case, none of these problems go away because you only have one theory.
Okay, so so this is this theory called MOND that was proposed. All right. I'm not sure which one, which version of, are you thinking of Tevez maybe? Bekenstein's tried attempt to make a gravity theory with scalar and vector fields that is sort of like MOND, but might be a consistent theory. That's been ruled out by careful observations of binary pulsars. Okay, well, but let me emphasize that, so MOND is this idea that Newton was wrong, that gravity is not a 1 over r squared force. It's only 1 over r squared down to a certain acceleration. And once the acceleration drops below that special value, it switches over and it becomes a 1 over r force. And that naturally gives you flat rotation curves. And flat rotation curves are what's seen, right? Wrong! Flat rotation curves are not seen in any galaxy that's been looked at sufficiently far out. Very important to appreciate. Remember I showed you that picture of what the Navarro-Frank-White density profile tells you? It tells you that you've got a velocity distribution that rises. It's roughly 1 over r, 1 over r squared. And then it's 1 over r cubed, and you get a rotation velocity that's falling. We now have data on thousands of galaxies from the Sloan survey. We have data where we've got satellite galaxies, and we can measure the mass by gravitational lensing. It is not consistent with MOND or anything like MOND.
It's consistent with my theory.
I don't know your theory. I'd like to learn it. What's your name?
It's called MOG, Modified Gravity.
Okay, well, please tell me about it. I'd like to look at it. You're aware of this paper by Clippen, by Prada and Clippen, that shows...
I disagree.
You can't disagree with the data. That's data.
No, no. It's misunderstood. Most galaxies do not show flat rotation. They rise up. No surface brightness galaxies.
Of course. Remember I showed you what the Navarro-Frank-White profile tells you. It rises up, it's flat, and then it falls. What I'm talking about is the falling part. Of course, the rising part is what you expect in the central region. Anyway, I'd like to look at your paper. I'm sorry I'm not familiar with it.
Anyone?
But MOND is certainly ruled out.
One more question for Joel before we go to lunch?
Yes.
So for the gap you showed for the stream,
the gaps.
Like much longer history that we have in observation. So there are some turbulent structures in the streams that comes from just actually from interactions, gravitational interactions. How do we distinguish these structures from the interaction of the dark?
So there's a fair amount of literature on that, and it's discussed in great detail, especially in the latest paper I showed, which is the one by Karlberg, Grillmeier, and collaborators. Basically, that one, they used a globular cluster, PAL-7, I think it is, which is a very puny little system, which moreover seems to have been completely torn apart. There's no globular cluster left. And so the amount of motion that could have occurred within that object must have been very small. But just to be on the safe side, they didn't even look close to the beginning of the stream. So I think if you want to have a detailed discussion of this, you should invite Ray Karlberg to come, because in several of his papers, he's discussed in considerable detail this potential objection to the method and shown that it's invalid. They're very aware of it, and they were careful to avoid any case where there might have been some trace of the motion in the original object. That's what you're basically asking about, right? And I think they did a good job on that.